When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What if the magic found in folklore existed today? Enter a world where witches, shapeshifters, and tricksters lurk in a park, at a garage sale, or in your favorite dive bar. Classic folktales meet modern life in The Other Path podcast, a new fantasy drama series by Odyssey Theatre. Discover where magic lurks this fall on Spotify.
Hello and welcome to the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. In 1943, a group of boys wandering the woodlands near Hagley Hall in Worcestershire in the West Midlands of England discovered the remains of an unknown woman stuffed inside a hollowed witch elm tree. Due to the war and increased movement around England, identifying the body proved difficult. She might have been someone local, or she might simply have been passing through. To this day, her identity remains unknown. In 1944, however, mysterious graffiti began to adorn the walls of the West Midlands, reading, "Who put Bella in the witch elm?" This graffiti reignited interest, and the theories about her were plentiful. Was she a prostitute named Bella, who had disappeared while working on nearby Hagley Road? Or perhaps a local woman that quarrelled with a mysterious Dutchman after becoming drunk at the Littleton Arms pub? A few years ago, these were questions that were taken up by independent filmmaker Tom Lee Rutter of Carney Films. Tom is based in the West Midlands in the UK and makes films of a fantastical and horror variety, including the award-winning docu-horror film Bella in the Witch Elm. From Nazi spy rings to an occult ritual which required a human sacrifice to obtain a hand of glory, Bella in the Witch Elm explores all the theories popular in the years after the discovery of the body, as well as giving a close look at the police investigation and forensic examination. The film premiered in 2017, and it has set Tom on a path of further exploring Fortean, folkloric, supernatural and experimental themes in other works, including the featurette Dr. Bolden Cross, Beyond the Void, in 2019, and the upcoming feature film, The Pocket Film of Superstitions. The Folklore Podcast's film and theatre correspondent Tracy Nicholas met with Tom to discuss the mysterious case of Bella in the Witch Elm and his take on it.
Okay, so I'm here with Tom Rutter, the director of Bella in the Witch Elm. And Tom, thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. And looking forward to talking about the film a little bit. Can we kick it off with having you tell a little bit about why this particular story appealed to you and what made you want to explore all of the different theories around it?
Okay, so I was born and bred in the Black Country, which is in the West Midlands. They call it the Black Country because the Black Country was pretty much one of the forerunners of the Industrial Revolution. So it was big on, you know, coal mines, foundries and, you know, steel mills. And the flag itself is a big chain to represent all the chain makers. And so that's the Black Country. There's a lot of down-to-earth, salt-of-the-earth type people, the Black Country folk. They're very much to the point. So In particular, I always use an example. My grandma. She, on the one hand, she would kind of bring me back down to earth with a good old, you know, slap around the face to say, you know, don't be so saft. She'd say, don't be so bloody saft. And but then on the other hand, they'd be so superstitious. You know, they'd talk about ghosts that they used to see or even commune with, and that always just was just always just a strange balance for me. And I'd think, well, they're so down to the point, and you know, very. Very blunt, but on the other hand, they totally believe in the afterlife, and they believe in ghosts, and they believe in, and they see, and they claim to see all these things. And who am I to question that? You know, so as a natural, naturally, I was brought up on ghost stories and things like that. You know, my mom would read to me and my brother about Bawley Rectory and all this unexplained phenomena, and it would just, you know, set our imaginations alight, even though we'd be absolutely terrified. So you know, it's not hard to imagine that, you know, you wouldn't go far without finding a place that's supposedly haunted. And so when the Bella mystery became known to me, it was just that perfect chance to make a film about that black country heritage, really, and what I was brought up on, that type of mindset. You know, I wanted to make something that was plain salt of the earth and, you know, also very spooky. And, you know, I don't think anything would encapsulate my background more, to be honest. And I was living with a friend who basically brought my attention to the graffiti. And and that was, to me, that was just the clincher. It was because it immediately had its roots in urban Gothic, because, you know, you think of Clive Barker's The Forbidden and things like that, and you think, wow, that's it's got this roots in this urban Gothic. How it's like, you know, it's this ominous kind of question that's sprayed across the walls in these industrial towns, and that just really set me, you know, set my imagination alight. Then I decided to look into the mystery.
Okay.
And that's when I found out that there were theories of witchcraft involved and espionage. It was really just, wow, just a full package of amazing elements. And, well, needless to say, I just fell down the rabbit hole. So when I kind of brought this story back to my folks, I'd speak to my nan about it and I'd speak to my mother about it. And it turns out, yeah, the Bella mystery has always been in the backdrop of their lives. My nan, and her friends as kids, they went up to Hagley Woods to look for Bella, you know, and you know, people's parents would punish them, or you know, if they were being naughty, they'd tell them, look, if you don't behave, I'll stuff you in the tree with Bella, you know. So it was really part of the fabric of black country culture. And you know, the graffito, it just set me off on that ominous kind of little journey to find out what it was all about. So and that's what happened, really.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even without all of the theories about how it came to be, it's such a strange story anyway, where, you know, like, what an odd way to hide a body, right? Stuffed in the tree like that. And you know, when I was watching, I thought, you know, what kind of strength would you have to like drag someone up? And, you know, and I thought you explored that really, really well. It was very interesting.
Thank you. Well, yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, if you think she's already dead and rigor mortis has started to set in and whatnot, like you said, it's a very elaborate way to hide a body, especially if they could just throw it in a cut or like an hour or something. But yeah, so I put a shout out in the newspaper, the local newspapers, and I was inundated with people who were phoning up. Some of them would be like anonymous, and they'd say, I don't want to leave my name, but I want to tell you that I found a revolver on the sidewalk, you know, by Hagley Woods around 1945. And then you'd have someone phone up saying, I used to know someone in Cradleaf, because Cradleaf is one of the black country towns, which, you know, black country towns all touch each other once you get into the black country. And then you get into Hagley, which is just after Stourbridge, and then it becomes a lot more rural, you see. So that's when you start crossing over into Worcestershire, and there's a lot more rurality over there, which gives it that kind of quaint pastoral, which brings in that kind of folk horror-y element to things. Mm-hmm. But in the black country, all these towns touch each other, and you'd have people get in touch saying, oh yeah, I used to read the Black Country Bugle, and there'd be a big story out in there, and there was this chap I knew around the time, and I can't really say for certain, but he was into some really dark arts, you know. And all this was just fueling my imagination, because none of them were giving you any definite answers, but they were just building those little blocks towards the big mystery of it all, you know.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting part about doing something that's more of an urban legend, because there are people who feel personally connected to it. It's not just, you know, a story from hundreds of years ago that has been passed down. But I think it's fascinating that people came to you with their, you know, all their theories on.
Absolutely. And that's what's so amazing about it, is that it is a piece of modern folklore. You know, it's only as old as World War II, you know, right. You know, the body was discovered in 1943. So, and then, you know, the strength of that as a folk tale now, it's quite remarkable, really. Mm-hmm. And it's inspired so many people in creative ways. I mean, we put on Bella themed nights, you know, where poets would turn up and, you know, they'd write whole little chapbooks on the Bella mystery, and that would be their interpretations. And then people would write their songs about it. So they'd be all brought together, you know, for these events. And it'd all be to celebrate the mystery, you know, which is amazing.
Yeah, I loved the, I don't know, poem, children's story, rhyme that you used at the beginning. That was really compelling. And how did you develop that?
Well, that was my my good friend Craigus, who writes a lot of the music for my films. He actually scored one of the silent film scores. We did an alternative silent film version, which adds some alternative scores just to really kind of soak up the atmosphere even further. And Craigus is such a wordsmith that I said, look, can you do a passage from the perspective of the disembodied spirit, you know, of Bella, and make it all encompassing about her situation, about, you know, what she means to the world now, and she's given herself over to a world of culture, you know, and that's what I wanted to do, really, is invoke the more poetic kind of aspects of the mystery, because it's quite amazing how many people you get connected with once you're kind of down the rabbit hole, so to speak, who want to solve the mystery. Whereas I never really wanted to do that, you know, it's magical as it is.
Yeah, that's interesting, because as I was watching, you know, of course, you get the finite story of the boys finding the skeleton, right? And I kind of thought that all of the different theories were going to come together at some way, and so it was great, because I was along for the ride the whole time, because I wasn't sure what was happening next, and I kept, you know, wanting that sort of like neat little bow to tie it up, but it got me in the spirit of, you know, telling those urban legend stories, that it was just all of these ideas and all of these possibilities. And it wasn't like, okay, well, now we're going to fictionalize the end of it for you. It was just nice to hear all the different ideas.
Yeah, that was definitely the intent, was to celebrate the art of storytelling and the folk tale itself. Because, you know, it wouldn't even matter if it was solved now to anybody, you know, I mean, some people, that's how they see the mystery. They see it as their chance to be a detective and to really, because some people have been doing, in particular, some authors, Andrew Spark for one, he's written a couple of books on the mystery, and the most extensive ones are by Alex Merrill and his father Pete Merrill, and they actually started investigations into Hagleywood, where they could trace the DNA from, you know, roots of trees back to who she could possibly have been, which is amazing, which is fine and fantastic. And it's great that people are really still dedicated to that cause. But myself, I just took those fantastical elements and embellished those. You know, I really wanted to celebrate the richness of how fantastical these strands were. And I love the fact that they just didn't go anywhere. It was just all speculation. So in a sense, I created a documentary that had completely fictitious passages.
But that's great, because that's the way these stories develop, and it is like seeing, you know, the folklore develop around it in real time. And you know, it's interesting to me of the different kinds of theories. You know, some are very, you know, cut and dried, this is a, you know, war you know, a spy issue, and some are very fantastical. I'm trying not to give away any spoilers, because part of the fun of watching the film is discovering as you go what all these different, you know, theories are and how they came to be.
Well, it mentions in the film mentions a Gestapo agent called Joseph Jacobs, who was like the last man to be executed at the Tower of London, and his granddaughter, was it, or some, she got in touch and she wanted to watch the film, and she wanted to put me right into a couple of little facts and of who he was, and again it was just like, well, he's just a very tenuous part of this story, but what he brought to it was still an interesting dimension. Mm-hmm. So it is just, again, it's people have all got their own you know, their own perspectives to add to the whole mix, and none of it will actually add up as a whole particularly. It's just amazing to see the variations, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for me I felt like the very like possible, like grounded in, you know, our everyday experience, as opposed to something a little more supernatural, that kind of story in here was just as compelling as the ones that are more fun to, you know, think about, the witchcraft and the voodoo and the black magic. But I felt like, you know, each story really had, you know, weight to it. And so I see why people, you know, who are creating these or you know, telling their theories.
Absolutely. I mean, I could have really have just carried on, you know, and given it at least a good another hour. I mean, you look at all these dense Netflix series that come out today. That is Bella's the perfect material for such a show, because you could really spread that out over 6 or 7 hour long episodes and really, really dissect it. I mean, I brought in the Charles Wharton murder. Have you ever heard of the Charles Wharton Lower Quinton murder?
I haven't. No.
Well, there was an early BBC play for today called Robin Redbreast, which was a kind of precursor to The Wicker Man. And that was based on a ritualistic murder that happened in Lower Quinton in Warwickshire, and basically an old farmer or farmhand even was found with his body pinned to the earth with a pitchfork, and there was a cross carved on his chest, and the locals, you know, they were very hush hush about what went on there, and a lot of people believed it to be a witch killing. But that was only 40 miles away from Hagley, you see. So for me, that was just, wow, join those dots. And this is the landscape we're living in, you know. You've got witch killings going on everywhere.
So can you talk? I noticed during the course of the film, it was, you know, largely black and white. But I felt like there, at least for me, there were three fairly distinct styles. You know, I felt like there was a sort of newsreel, like 1940s newsreel style. There was a little bit more of a creepy, ominous style. Can you talk a little bit about what those different feels were for the different kinds of theories?
Sure thing. Absolutely. Well, for a start, I wanted to acknowledge the fact that I was making a film in 2017, 2016, I was shooting it. So, you know, anything goes really in this postmodern world and how you approach cinema. So I was, you know, very much inspired a lot by silent cinema, in particular Hexen, because it's a no-brainer with Hexen. And then obviously you have pseudo documentaries such as Wisconsin Death Trip, which, mm-hmm. you know, illustrates some passages found in newspaper articles which are featured in the book. And yet they were just this kind of really creepy, but yet gentle and beautiful, text of passages and vignettes. And it was all in this really eerie black and white. And I thought, well, you know, Bella itself, the whole whatever went on is a faded memory. It's all a haze. And everything else is just a feverish run of theories. So I wanted to give off the idea of that it was a fever dream or a hazy memory. So a lot of the shots, in particular when we see Bella's spectre towards the end, I kind of covered the lens with sweet wrappers so it would distort the image somewhat and give it this kind of really kind of hazy, dreamy, bleary eyed feel to it. And then when we come into the 50s, the 40 with the munitions and the espionage, I wanted to give it a bit of a more of a glow, so it looked like those real beautiful soft focus films in the 40s when the light would hit something, it would glow. So there's a little there's an element of 40s cinema in there, silent cinema, but then just whatever I can kind of, you know, do to kind of enforce this kind of dreamlike, feverish kind of atmosphere, you know. And there was a lot of overlays going on as well, so it enabled me to just play with this kind of, you know, dreamlike slash, you know, trippy textures, just to kind of, yeah, just to kind of give you something that was otherworldly, really, because everything is all just speculative and all a thought and a dream. So, and that's how it should have come across without that kind of clarity, really.
Yeah, I felt like things sort of started clear in a lot of scenes, and then they kind of narrowed to a little bit more of a tunnel vision. And that usually happened when things got mysterious or creepy. And I really, I loved that, because I found myself like leaning in, you know, because it was like, as it was getting smaller, I was getting drawn into it. So
thank you. Yeah, that, there was definitely a lot of claustrophobia in there, because I use a lot of vignettes and iris wipes and whatnot. So that really did kind of narrow the picture down to what you're focusing on. And sometimes that's just an expression, or it is just like an item or an object, or it's something that's quite spooky and horrific. But that's something I've really gone to town with. You know, it's something I'm still experimenting with now, because I just feel like we're in an age now of so much HD clarity, and we've gone 4K, 8K, and I want to go the other way. You know, I want to strip that back, and yep. I want films to be able to evoke, you know, a kind of dream state atmosphere, and just an atmosphere in general. Mood pieces, you know,
right.
We still need mood pieces.
Well, I feel like, you know, with the hyper clarity, it doesn't engage your imagination as much. And that's what was, you know, fun about, well, it was one of the fun things about this, is that it got me going, and it's like, ooh, I wonder, are those two things connected? Maybe they are, you know, it sort of got me in that mindset, whereas if you just handed everything and been like, here's exactly what it is, I wouldn't have engaged in the same way.
No, this is it. It's all about promoting the unknown as well, because that's what fires our imaginations the most, you know. So why would we want to tie anything up and give people clarity? Even in the scenes themselves, it's like, we might be showing what we're showing, but we might not be showing what we're showing, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we've all stumbled upon strange things going on in the woods in the past. I'd like to think we all have anyway. So, you know, you're not quite sure what you're seeing sometimes. I mean, you know, I've seen strange things in the past where I genuinely can't trust my own eyes, you know. So it's nice to be able to just throw these ideas out there and to really just create a sense of unease and wonder, you know, and the best way to go about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the whole feeling of the, like, being claustrophobic, you know, it kept you in that state of like this, you know, this tiny space where this poor woman's body was. And I think that's part of what, you know, has people still, you know, thinking about it and making, you know, exploring these theories and wanting to you know, that's why it's interesting.
And thank you. Yeah. I mean, you know, and I always like to kind of underscore those moments where it goes into a sense of sinister passage, and then kind of throw you into the next scene with just the sound of bird song, you know. So there's a you know, there's a peaceful surface above what's going on underneath, and we all love the strange and the sinister, what goes on beneath the surface of what we see as a normal facade, really, don't we? So it was such an adventure making it, and I have to admit, you know, the less kind of romantic reason why I enforced a lot of these techniques was because we literally have no money as well, and the best way to convey our ideas is to really strip back and, you know, limit ourselves to what we are seeing, and then it masks the seams, you know, not all of them, admittedly, but it you're also creating an atmosphere with nothing, so you're able to take away what's around you and just home in on the slightest of things, because sometimes you'll turn the camera left or right and you're faced with a modern atrocity that would not look good on camera. But with the power of, you know, framing and vignettes, you can really home in on what's still there, you know, and what you can lyricize with it.
Well, and I think that you can mask some, you know, lazy filmmaking with a big budget. And, you know, you just start pouring money into it. You can make, you know, have beautiful vistas and, you know, do all of that. And it's, you know, a way to, you know, have people be like, oh, that was really great. I was so into it. It was so beautiful. Whereas, you know, this was about the story. And I think when you do, you know, you don't have all those added layers that a ton of money will bring you. I think that you have to. You have to get really serious about the story and how you're going to, you know, convey the emotions that you want and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. I think what really grounded the film all in all was our narrator, because he was actually, he used to live around the corner from where I grew up. So his accent was very familiar to me. And I couldn't have done the film without a Black Country narrator, because his accent is legitimate Black Country. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think, you know, a lot of people would meet my uncles. I mean, my wife doesn't understand a lot of my family from the Black Country. And, you know, some of the accents are so broad. It's a fascinating surviving strand of old English, essentially. He really kind of brought the film down to earth, which enabled me to get more experimental with the visuals, because then, you know, the experimentalism of the film would not just alienate the audience then, because our narrator kept us grounded. I wanted to give it that sense of, you know, meeting someone in a pub who was a really good recanter, who could just tell you the story.
Right. And, you know, I really liked his delivery style, because he lent to the film this kind of gleeful telling scary stories around a campfire, where like he's just as excited to scare you as you want to be scared. And he really has that energy when he's talking.
Absolutely. He has this warmth. So it's like, even though you're creeped out, you still feel quite safe with him, you know. He gives you that kind of quaint kind of scare where, you know.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, let me build this, you know, space, and we're going to explore some creepy stuff in here. But don't worry, I'm going to be here for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, he was perfect. Absolutely perfect. You know, and I really can't thank Tatty Dave enough for doing that for me, because it was perfect, absolutely perfect.
Yeah, he definitely made it a lot more fun. I can't imagine a different narrator, because he had exactly the right, you know, tone to it all.
And it was also a conscious decision, because again, I was making the film with no money, and it was a mixture of budding actors and just friends, you know, and anyone who kind of looked right for the part and whatever we could get. But I knew that the film would potentially be cheapened by less than stellar performances. So you take dialogue out of the scenario and just let the narrator do the talking, the narrator who can deliver, and then all they are then are a series of expressions, you know. So it kind of, I think it survives the kind of the trappings of a lot of low budget filmmaking and no budget filmmaking by going down that route, you see. And I think that was probably a good move on that part, you know, to take out the acting.
Yeah, and it also, it drew me kind of into a being in the past mindset, because it did have a little bit of a silent film kind of feel to it. Where, you know, the music was giving you clues about, okay, you know, you're boys running around in the woods, it's all, and then it gets creepy. And so it just, the having just like the narration and the voiceover, it really took me in my mind to a different time. And so that I thought was very effective.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I mean, you know, I do often wonder whether it'd be the most successful film I made, because, you know, it kind of does what it sets out to do, and because it's got such a broad appeal with the mystery itself, and then there's lovers of the, you know, the burgeoning folk horror genre, as well as just people who enjoy indie films. But, you know, I feel like it kind of attract several different circles in that respect. And I think as a result, people, it will always get an audience, you know, which I'm very proud of, you know.
Okay, now I have to ask this question. So there's a whole bunch of theories. We've talked about it. Do you have a pet theory yourself? Do you have a favorite?
I did not single any out at what, until I met with Pete Merrill. Pete Merrill and his son, they investigated the, you know, the mystery on a scholarly level to the point where they released two really extensive books. The titles were, the volume one was Who Put Bella in the Witch Elm, volume one, The Crime Scene Revisited. And then they released volume two, A Crime Shrouded in Mystery. And I really recommend those books. But I actually met Pete at the Littleton Arms, which is the pub featured in the story, you know, and obviously it's been done up since. So it doesn't look like a quaint old pub anymore. It looks quite like a flash eatery now, which is a shame. But and that's where Pete and I got chatting, and Pete told me pretty much about the, people say it's a theory, but Pete is pretty convinced that this is what happened, really, is that she was a gypsy, a traveller, and because back then, you know, it was always in the information that there was no one reported missing from the neighbouring towns. Well, the traveller communities, they would be on their own, you know, they would make camp nearby, and something happened, and this traveller got killed. There was reports of a traveller running through one of the towns, bloodied the one time, and information was known to the police and brought to their desk. But as with most cases, insufficient evidence meant they just didn't care to follow it up and close the book on it. Mm-hmm. And that was that. You know, and it's very likely that it was a traveller. And even the pub, it was called the Badger's Set when I was growing up, but it used to be called the Gypsy's Tent because there was a lot of gypsy camps around that area at that time. Mm-hmm. And she could have come from one of these camps that had made camp nearby, and something happened amongst their own politics, right, and she wound up dead. And to me, that kind of gave it the most, you know, for me, that was the most plausible theory.
Yeah, and that would have been a very marginalized community, because people were suspicious, and there was, you know, a lot of fear that they were going to come and, you know, steal, and so I think it does make it pretty plausible that the police wouldn't care that much to investigate it, because
absolutely,
it's like, that's not our problem, you know, we're here, we live in this town, this is our town, they're going to be gone, so let them go.
And they're very marginalized today. So, you know, and you can imagine how it was back then, even more so. So you're absolutely right. And there was a war on as well. So, you know, they just did not care to chase it up. And to me, that is like, yeah, okay, that sounds very much like what may well have happened. But, you know, we still haven't got the defining evidence to put that into place to say so. So as far as I'm concerned, it's still an open book.
Well, and you know, it brings up an interesting point that I did notice about the language that you used. And it did feel like you were using language from the era that the film was set, like using the word gypsy, you know, which, yes, as we get, you know, more PC, it's, you know, can't use that word. It's a slur. They're travelers. They're, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But that was how it was then.
Yeah. Well, the reason I did that was actually lifted verbatim from one of the newspaper articles that we based it on, because the framing device has the Byford Quester Jones, the reporter for the Express and Star. He did a 10-year follow-up on the mystery, like I think it was three extensive articles. And I went up to Wolverhampton to one of the resource centres where you had those scanners where you look through old newspaper articles. And I must have spooled through so many reels to try and find these articles, and I did find them. And then I just lifted chunks of those articles to shape the narration, essentially. And that was one of them. The theory of the traveller was when he would go to St. Canelm's Church and speak with the man tending to the garden outside. And those were the words that he said to Quester Jones. And I wanted to lift that again, just like you said, to give it that air of authenticity and to just kind of mark what was written and what's been said, you know.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we're trying to make something appropriate for our time, it's takes it out of context. It takes the story out of context, you know, mm-hmm. because if it had happened now, you know, they would have been doing DNA tests. They would have been, you know, there would have been a different kind of, you know, way of thinking about it. And if the police were just like, hey, you know, not our problem, that's their own community, that would never happen now. So I think it's important to understand a story within the context of like when it happened and how people's thinking were at the time.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was something that was on my mind throughout making it, but I believe the narrator has family in the traveller community, as well as the fact that you'll see some footage in it with the Vardos just in a procession, the wagons. And that was a procession into a festival that's held three times a year where the traveller community come together and they have a knees up, you know. And someone just filmed the horse-drawn procession coming into the field. And I asked the man who filmed it if I could use it in the film, and he was more than happy to let me use it. So the last thing I wanted to do was upset the community, because, you know, it was all about, like you say, it's all about just instilling a sense of time and place and what's, you know, a frame of mind and, a frame of mind of a time, really, concerning something that was... that was unspeakable for, you know, quiet little parish, civil parishes, you know, something that's, you know, far too sinister and too something out of place, you know.
Yeah, definitely. It was great to hear you talk about Quester. That's how you say it, Quester?
I believe it is, yeah. I weren't quite sure. Again, me and Tatty Day, we would sit there and deliberate over how certain things were said, you know. And I said, well, Tatty, you know, you've got your own way of speaking anyway, so just go with what you feels right, you know.
Yeah, that was a fascinating character, how he just like couldn't let it go and kept, you know, trying to figure out what had happened. I really liked him.
Yeah, that's it. It's just nice to create some form of thread that brings these vignettes together, because let's face it, a lot of them were just fragments, you know. And obviously from a production standpoint, it was brilliant for me because I was able to bring people together for a day or two and then just wave them off and then bring in the new set of performers and then just worry about the narrator joining all that together. But Quester was also the visual that brought that together, because he'd go from one sequence to another and take us there.
Can we now move on to the companion piece, The Midnight Hour?
Oh, certainly, absolutely.
Okay. My first question is, which did you develop first?
Well, so I premiered Bella at our local town hall, Kidderminster Town Hall, July 2017. And one of the actors in the film, he brought along his friend, and, you know, he was wearing this khaki kind of jacket, and he was smoking a pipe, and he had this big moustache, and his hair was slicked back. And I was like, wow, who's your friend? He introduced me to him, and I just immediately thought he would look good as this kind of this TV personality, this paranormal investigator type. And we just kind of got chatting, we'd go for drinks, and we'd talk about developing this character called Dr. Baldwin Cross. And now, you know, in the run-up to Bella and throughout those years anyway, I was just devouring all this this old Fortean kind of and paranormal TV from like the 70s and 80s that were usually on, you know, ATV, ITV, BBC. And a lot of them existed as really like kind of rough VHS rips on YouTube, because some of them still haven't had legitimate releases. I mean, I know like labels like the BFI and Network, they clean a lot of them up and release them, but some of them still haven't seen the light of day. And some of them are very esoteric, you know. You know, people had conviction on television. They'd be talking about the dark arts, and there was a, you know, very prevalent kind of interest in Wiccan activities and witchcraft and things like this. But they took it very, very seriously on these shows. And I love that, you know, I love that. Yeah. So I really wanted to just recreate something like that. And going back to what I going back to Robin Redbreast, the BBC play for today, which was about which was based on the Charles Walton murder. That was actually broadcast in colour, but because the BBC used to wipe a lot of these shows after they were broadcast, they could only find this black and white kind of really rough black and white copy.
Okay.
And that's the one that got released. And you can see when you watch it, the visuals got a lot of ghosting in it. And, you know, so there's a kind of sort of fifth generation vibe about it all. And I love that because that's a texture in itself. And I just wanted to recreate that or see if I could recreate that. So, you know, I said to Dave, let's write a piece. And then we went to Kidderminster Town Hall and we filmed it. And originally, I was going to get a distribution deal for Bella in the States, but the distributor wanted the Bella to be an hour long. And I wasn't willing to extend the film itself because I thought to do that would cheapen it and, you know, take away from what it is. So I thought, well, why not create these passages with Dr. Baldwin Cross as a bookend and release it like that. And we tried it like that. And again, it just didn't quite work. I'm trying to add to something that's finished in my eyes. Mm-hmm. So once Bella was out there, Dave Pearl, who plays Dr. Baldwin Cross, we decided to just write a whole film about Dr. Baldwin Cross. So we created a half an hour film about his life and work and included some of the shows he was in. We even included a scene of a sort of Hammer horror-esque film that he starred in the once. And it was called A Coffin for Lady Dracula. And then we'd talk about how he died and how he promised his colleagues and friends that he would send a message back from the void. And the film ends in a seance. But the film starts with those black and white clips of a show he did called The Midnight Hour. And I haven't used those clips since we tried to extend the Bella cut. And I thought, well, you know what? Let's take all that footage and create a whole episode of The Midnight Hour, but base it on the Bella mystery. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. So I thought it would be a nice addition to anyone who got their copy of Bella and the Witch Helm.
Yeah, I mean, I watched it after I watched Bella. And first of all, it is hilariously campy. I think it is so perfect. You get that 70s feel. It's sort of that over the top melodramatic, like, ooh, mystery. And so I think that you nailed it on the tone. And it's so very different than Bella. But to me, it sort of added some depth because, you know, I'm in the States, so I was not familiar with any of this story, and I didn't, you know, I went and researched a little after, but before I came in cold and, you know, watched it a couple of times. And then when I watched the Midnight Hour episode, it did add a different sort of depth for me because I was like, oh, these stories really are real. And seeing the, you know, use some of the same images and it but to have it sort of be talked through what, you know, this mystery is in such a different kind of way than how you did it in Bella and the Witch Elm. It made it fun and it sort of cemented some of those, you know, the more witchcraft and black magic voodoo side of things that, you know, was a little more balanced in, you know, the other piece. It was definitely a lot of fun. You've kind of answered all of my questions about
Obviously the great thing about it was obviously back in the day, you know, when you tune into TV, you'd see a lot of interesting people just talking on camera, you know, to each other or to the camera. So production wise it was so sparse that you could just sit this guy in front of a camera and he would talk with conviction about all these esoteric interests that he has, including, you know, the witchcraft, witch trials, and just the old nature of folklore. So I thought, well, that's going to be relatively simple to do, you know. Mm-hmm. And Dave Pearl, he just had such conviction in saying it. He turned up wearing the turtleneck with the necklace, and
yeah.
And I didn't have to prompt him with that. He knew who Dr. Baldwin Cross was, and that's why we were just the perfect fit, you know. So And then I got my wife to play some sort of Bel Air historian to sit, and she's talking to the camera just to break it up a little bit. But no, I really, it was just to further enforce that kind of spooky British kind of Fortean kind of hauntological kind of fascination we all have with those kind of old shows now, you know. Yeah, there's a lot of fans of those.
And it's interesting because at this point, you know, anybody can make a video, right? Even if it's not great quality, but, you know, people are filming stuff all the time. But back then, you know, it was, you had to like get equipment that most people didn't have. And, you know, it was a more unusual person who would be doing that kind of work. And so, you know, and of course that gorgeous, like big, heavy 70s furniture, and, you know, like how dramatic he seems in, you know, even how he's decorating and where he's, you know, placing himself. So yeah, it was good fun. All I can say about it is, please consider making this a series, because I want to see more of these.
Dave would love to hear that. I mean, I will pass on a copy of Dr. Born Across Beyond the Void, and you can watch that, and then you get more Dr. Born Across to enjoy, because we consider another series he made further down the line called Worlds Beyond, and that was his more, you know, his colour effort in the early 80s sort of thing, and so, you know, there's a lot to enjoy there. So I'm sure you'll enjoy it, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If I can implore to keep that going, because I want more. I need more.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm making a follow-up film which kind of employs a lot of the same kind of visual style as To Bella in the Witch Elm. It's actually called The Pocket Film of Superstitions. I didn't really want to kind of strike twice and find another really compelling folk tale or story to delve in. So I thought, well, you know how you used to get these books of almanacs of superstitions and things like this. So I thought, well, why not just make a film, one of those, a film version of one of those, you know? So it's a sprawling kind of series of vignettes of various superstitions through the ages, which gives me a chance to portray things like changelings, fairies, witches, and you know, and in very much the same kind of visual style, but with a slightly more polished and obviously with a bigger budget as well. But I'm thinking of getting Dr. Baldencross back to introduce something like that, you know. So
yeah.
So watch this space.
Okay, so for the Midnight Hour, do you have a favorite part of this one, or was it just all sort of a little fun ride the whole way, like it was for me?
Oh, it was I think for me it was getting the texture right of how it was slightly ghosting the image, you know, you can see a slight overlap, and just the general graininess of it all. I had to get that right because, you know, I am a sucker for using grain plugins. I mean, if I had the money, I would be shooting on film, but because I don't have that kind of money, I have to convince myself to make it look filmic enough, you know. Uh-huh. And sometimes you can tell that it's just a digital offering with that kind of grain pot on top of it. So I thought, I really want to strip back that, again, just get rid of all that HD-ness and soften it to the point where I believe that is a kind of old transmission from yesteryear. And that's my favourite part of it, was just pulling that off, I guess, really. And the score itself, some of it was actually pre-made music, but some of it was me on like a virtual theremin, just kind of wailing it up and down and just recording minutes of that.
That's awesome.
Which added to the over-the-topness, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking, like with the sound, I was thinking that it was, you know, those instruments they had in the 70s where you just kind of move around them.
Yeah, and absolutely. A big theremin, you know.
Theremin. Yeah, that, I mean, and immediately, like, I didn't know the name of it, but I was like, oh, that's that thing they did in the 70s. That's, you know, it was perfect.
Well, you know, in Beyond the Void, we kind of we hint that he had, because he ended up forming his own institute called the Paratheological and Metaphysical Institute, the PMRI. And it was under the PMRI where they had their own little TV production wing. And that's where he made The Midnight Hour and Worlds Beyond. And then we hinted that he had his own little sonic sound studio in there, which was our play on the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. So instead of Delia Derbyshire, you had Celia Clampton and stuff like that, you know.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah. But, you know, you'll see it when you see the film, you know.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm very excited about that. Okay. So is there anything else that we haven't covered that you'd like to share?
Oh, you know, this kind of stuff can just go sprawling off in so many different directions. And I fell down the Bella rabbit hole, and it got to a point where people would still get in touch after the film was, you know, out there. And I just couldn't throw myself back into it because it was so taxing, you know. And a paranormal investigator called Jane Harris, she made a documentary around the same time, and hers was a lot more investigative, and there was a lot more kind of theories being posed there, and you know, evidential photos and whatnot, which is well worth a look. But I just thought, well, I've made my statement. I didn't want to solve the case. I just wanted to celebrate the unknown, and I just feel like every film I make, it's all about just, you know, celebrating the unknown, really. So I just felt like I'd had my time with it. I still absolutely adore it, but it was so all consuming that I just had to back away for a while, you know.
Right. Oh, of course. So where can people access, you know, these two films or your other work?
We've got a Bella and the Witch on Blu-ray, which comes with The Midnight Hour, plus a silent movie cut that we did. Because I know the film was set in the 40s onwards, but I just love silent cinema. And I thought, well, you know, I'm making this film in 2016, 17. Anything goes, right? So let's do a silent movie cut with intertitles. And that's got three scores to choose from. And you get an A3 poster as well. And it's a lovely set. Really can't recommend it enough, but I would say that. We're selling that on our own Big Cartel. That's on the Facebook. You can get that on the Facebook. So there's a Bella and the Witch on page on Facebook. There's a... I'm on Twitter as Tom Lee Ritter. So yeah, you can find me, and from there you can find the link to purchase it, and with information on the upcoming films. The Pocket Film of Superstitions is still in production, where we're a lot more, you know, we've gone a bit more all out on that one. It's taken me quite a long time to make, but I'm blaming other kind of external forces, like the lack of money and, you know, the pandemic and stuff like this.
Little things.
Exactly. Yeah. But we're lucky that we've got some cult film royalty in that one. We've got Caroline Monroe playing a high priestess witch, and Lynn Lowry's in it as well, doing a sequence about superstitions involving hand gestures and things like this. So from those links, you can find out more about what's coming and how you can get your hands on and Bella and the exploits of Dr. Baldwin Cross.
Great. I'm looking forward to seeing more.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to Tom and Tracy for that discussion on Bella in the Witch Elm. The original film was recently remastered onto a Blu-ray release with extra features, and you can buy a copy by visiting Tom's website at carneyfilms.blogspot.com. You can also find Tom on Twitter and Facebook by searching for Carney Films. That's Carnie, Carney. I'll put the links on the episode page for this episode on the Folklore Podcast website. If you've never done so, please spare us a few seconds to leave a rating or a review for the Folklore Podcast on whichever platform you listen. Positive ratings help new audiences to find us. After 7 seasons, the Folklore Podcast remains proudly independent. We rely on the generosity of our listeners to keep going, and a great way to do this is via our Patreon page, which will earn you access to exclusive supporter content. We're hoping to revamp this over the winter period in order to bring you even more rewards for your support, so it's a great time to join if you can, and you can do so for as little as £1 a month. It's also possible to make one-off donations and buy books and other merchandise via our website at www.thefolklorepodcast.com. You can also support us by simply sharing our episodes widely with others. Please do, And don't forget to tag us in anything interesting. You can find us on Twitter at FolklorePod. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.